Good evening, everyone. Broadcasting live. Welcome to our live broadcast. Today's quote is about three types of people, three individuals. Ayomi, Pugala, Loke, Upadjamana, Upajanti. Bahujana hitaya, bahujana sukaya, lokanukampaya, ataya, hitaya, sukaya, deva manusana. These three beings, when they're born for the benefit of many, for the happiness of many, for the compassion for the world, for the benefit and well-being and happiness of divine and human beings. It's a good thing, no? There's three types of people whom you can think of as being of great benefit to the world. Great when they are born. Who do we think of as being great people? We think of great people as those who change the world, those who bring justice to the world. And we often think of evil people as being great in the sense of great evil. But when we think of those who are of great benefit to the world, we have, well, it depends who you ask, of course, but we go through history, or some of the, I guess, religious leaders would often be held in that regard. Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, Lao Tzu, Bodhidharma, Shinran, and then you have modern figures, political figures, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., the mystics like there's this guy in Bulgaria I was told about. What's his name? There are people like Einstein. These great people who are a great benefit to the world, supposedly. But benefit is a tricky thing, right? What is a real benefit? If someone builds lots of hospitals, is that a benefit to the world? If someone overthrows a political regime, is that a benefit to the world? What is really a benefit? You know, there's many things that are ostensibly quite obviously beneficial, but on a deeper level, what is a real benefit? Because there are many things that seem to be a benefit, but in the end don't solve. It's not that they don't solve problems, it's that they don't actually solve problems. Like take healthcare, for example. If you cure sickness or build hospitals, this is a good thing. I think from a Buddhist point of view, this is a good thing. But bringing about health on a physical level isn't a goal in and of itself. Because you're still going to get sick and die, and you're going to be born again and get sick again and die again. And bringing about political change isn't an end in and of itself. And it's funny, we have to think that is an end in and of itself. If we're able to topple a corrupt government, and we feel like we're victorious, you know, democracy has won. For how long, right? We can see the democracies of today being corrupted, having really been corrupted since the beginning. You know. We talk about saving the planet. We talk about any mundane benefit turns out to be circumscribed by impermanence. And that's important in this sense, to get a sense of why there's only three types of people who are the Buddha considered to be great benefit, and why these three are the highest. It's because these three have found something that is permanent, that is lasting, that is truly meaningful in that sense. If you have a goal or a benefit that is temporary, well, in the face of eternity, it doesn't actually mean much at all. It doesn't mean anything. Something that makes you, that brings you peace for a short time and then is gone, it means that quite meaningless, because eternity is a long time. This is, I think, crucial in terms of the difference between a view of nihilism, there being nothing after death, and the view of there being, of eternalism, there being existence for eternity. If there's nothing after death, then well, everything is meaningless. Something that has real meaning. Meaning is incredibly limited. If after death there's nothing, if our, the whole sum of our existence in this universe is one life. I mean, it obviously makes some good sense with the empirical evidence that we have from a physical point of view. It doesn't make any sense from a mental point of view. It doesn't make any sense from the point of view of this consciousness being distinct from all other consciousness. The idea that at death there could be nothing. It's a very, it's a pernicious sort of belief. It doesn't in the end hold up to scrutiny. And I know this is a controversial topic, and so there are people who are quite vehement that belief in rebirth is not warranted, it's not necessary. Anyway, I digress. I'm going to make it clear that I'm coming from a point of view that reality is continuous. Reality is based on experience, and experience doesn't end just because the body breaks up. The body isn't real anyway. It's not a part of experience. And it affects the body breakup affects experience. It can disrupt it, but it can't destroy it. Not when there's still craving, I suppose. Because craving is productive. It creates, perpetuates the system. Anyway, so the point being that these three types of people are those who have found a way out, who have found freedom, we've come to experience true bliss and release and true peace. The first is, of course, the Buddha. This quote is actually just the verse from the sutta. It's a sutta the Buddha talks about. The Pali that I quoted earlier is the actual sutta. It says there are three types of people. The first is a Buddha who arrives and who describes the Buddha in all his qualities. And he teaches the Dhamma that is good in its beginning, beautiful in its beginning, beautiful in its middle, and beautiful in its end. With Sattang Sambayanjanam. It's funny, this is something that we actually chant this in Thailand. Idadatha agato loke upajjati upajjo upajjo arahana sama sambhuto vijacharana something. Different tents of basically the same thing. So when a Buddha arises, this is of course a great benefit. It's a real benefit because there's a benefit to the Buddha's teaching that is eternal. It changes the course of one's journey. It provides a true end to the journey. Allows us to find the goal, to come to a destination. The other two are followers of the Buddha. So an arahant, follower of the Buddha, who is arahant hoti kina suru, who is one who has cut off the taints, who, like the Buddha, has freed themselves from suffering. The Buddha is like the first, he said he's like the first, through a bunch of eggs, the Buddha is like the first that hatch. All the rest hatch after, but they're the same, it's the same freedom. And so these beings are also not understood to be as knowledgeable about the path as the Buddha. I mean, they've relied upon the wisdom of others to propel them to freedom. So their enlightenment is considered to be inferior in the sense that they're not really clear, they're not entirely clear about what they've done. Maybe that is not fair. Well, they're lesser than them. They don't have all the knowledge of the Buddha. Certainly very profound and very much able to teach the path that they have followed to others. The third is a Seka. Seko hoti patipado bahusuto sila vattupando. Savaka, a follower, who is a Seka. Seka means someone who is Sika. Sika means training. Seka is someone who is in training. This is someone who has seen nirvana for themselves, but is still working on purifying their mind. So they're practicing, and they are bahusuto. They have heard much and have silavato. They are someone who is who's attained to who's moral, who's ethical. And what this means is they've attained to ethics means through the realization of Nibbana for the first time, there's a certain minimum ethic that an enlightened being of this sort will keep, even though they still have greed, they still have anger, they still have delusion. They've come to what the Buddha called Aryakantasila, which is a morality that is beloved of the noble ones. The noble ones keep this morality. They don't kill, they don't steal, they don't cheat, they don't lie. They might still be unpleasant and do things wrong. Just not wrong to an extreme. So these three, whether we become one or whether we're talking about who we associate with, three beings that are worth thinking about. They're the highest among gods and humans. They are bringers of light, speakers of Dhamma. They open the doors of the immortal, the deathless one, and set many beings free from bondage. You don't have to be an arahant to lead others. Even someone who is a sotapanna has a great wisdom that they can share. Even just a sotapanna. Someone who has seen Nibbana for themselves. They've been there. And they know the destination. They can describe the path that leads to that destination. So that's the Dhamma for today. I have no meditators here. Michelle left this morning, and then this afternoon our new meditator came to report, and just now I went downstairs to go to the washroom and saw his door was open. Sure enough, there was a note on his desk saying he'd gone. Which happens. You know, it's really the only... If you're concerned, if you come to meditate here and you're concerned about what it'll be like, what the results will be, whether you'll succeed. Many meditators are worried about whether they'll succeed, whether they'll actually be capable of practicing. And that's it really. The only way you can fail this course is by leaving. I mean, it's not to say even it's a failure, but you can't succeed if you leave. And again, I'm not really criticizing this person. It's difficult. He was young, he was under 20. 20 tends to be a bit of a cutoff. But it's a tough course. And often people who leave early come back, but it's not easy. This is what this does happen. People don't, you don't go crazy practicing this type of meditation. It's not something that you can actually get on the wrong path. What happens is people are just leave. It's difficult. You're alone in a room for much of the day. So there's no shame in leaving. Can't take it. Come back and try again. Anyway, he said it helped him staying here a couple of days, so to start. But so that means we have space right now. If anyone wants to come and meditate, we have space just opened up. Beyond that, we're full for August, half of September, and we've already got people signed up for October and November. Even December. And Robin's here. Good evening, Robin.
Sati Bhante.
So are you coming tomorrow? No, when are you coming?
Tomorrow.
Okay. And how long are you staying?
I was worried that there wouldn't be room for me to stay for a couple of days to meditate after I helped move. But if there is room, I'd like to. I actually don't have to be back at work until the 24th.
Well, there's room. I mean, I think we have a lot of room in July, don't we? Or do we have people coming? I know later on in the month we do, but...
Yeah, I can just leave it flexible. If there are people there and you need the space, I can leave early. If there's room, I'd like to stay and meditate for a couple of days after the move, if possible, if there's room.
Right, so there's someone coming this Saturday, and then another person on Monday, and then another person on... Oh, but by that time we'll be moved, right? So when we move, we have four rooms. We've got room right up until 22nd August. Am I reading that right? No. first of August. First of August, we're full. With four web games. But we're not even full then, you know. We do have a spare room. We could fit a fifth meditator. What do you think?
In the new place.
So we've got six rooms, right?
I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen what those rooms look like.
They're all big. Six big rooms.
Oh, okay.
That's about it. If you think of a building with six big rooms, some hallways, and a big living room, that's it. And there's no dining room, or there's a kitchen as well. A kitchen and a big living slash dining room. It's a pretty simple house.
Is there a washer and dryer?
Yes.
Good.
Kind of
very important.
Tucked into one corner, and two bathrooms, which is... No, two full bathrooms, which is better than this place. And someone asked how far it is from Hamilton. It's actually not far from here. It's in Hamilton. We're here. The university is here. It's here. But just a little further away from the university on the other side.
So is it walking distance from the old place?
No. Well, it depends what you mean by walking. It would take you a couple hours, I'd assume. An hour maybe? Actually, I don't know. It takes about a half an hour to get from here to the university, I think. I've done it. I think it's about a half an hour. So, it's probably closer to an hour from here. Probably more, I'm not sure. But it's kind of the other direction. The university is that way. New places is that way.
Most important question, is there a Tim Hortons nearby for your breakfast latte?
Well, this is the thing. No, there's not. There's no Tim Hortons, no Subway, no Pita Pig.
No.
There's a diner. So maybe you and I could go to the diner and work something out. Maybe that's where we have to do it. Start going through the... I mean, there's also the question of whether we want to set up an account with the university again.
Sure.
That's terribly convenient, if not cheap.
Well, food in Canada doesn't tend to be cheap. You know, no matter where you get it, it seems like.
It's what?
Food in Canada is very expensive, no matter where you get it, so...
Did you say expensive? Well, you have to remember, our dollar isn't as much, doesn't... cost as much as yours, I suppose you understand that.
Sure.
Really nice.
Yeah, everything with that food in Canada is pretty costly stuff.
Hmm.
You know, I think no matter where you go, I'm sure your supporters want you to get the best possible nutrition, the healthiest fare that's available. So is the food at the university fairly healthy?
Sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, sorry. Is the food at the university fairly healthy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one thing you can say about university food. It may cost an arm and a leg, but actually it's not that. It's not really much more expensive than food outside of the university. Honestly, they say how expensive it is. I don't think it's that expensive, comparatively. But yeah, it's very healthy. You can get really good quality food. Good vegetarian food, especially if you're vegetarian.
Sounds like a good option to set up an account for you.
But I imagine the diner is much cheaper.
Okay.
And on days that I don't go to the university, it's a lot closer. So maybe we can go talk to them. Who knows, maybe they're Buddhist sympathizers. Alright, so do we got some questions?
We do. What exactly is the designation of our tradition? I know Hasi Sai Da mentioned the other day. What is the official answer when someone asks about it? And it was a great explanation of the type of meditation yesterday, so thanks for that. Maybe lineage just always asking about it.
Someone said I looked tired yesterday. I think I am. It's kind of, it's this weird sort of transition. I still haven't completely transitioned to Canadian time, so somehow my body is deciding to shut down around 8 p.m. or something. Because really, in a few hours I'll be wide awake. This is a little bit of a dazed. My body's not sure what I'm trying to do to it. I'm moving from Thailand to Sri Lanka back to Canada. And I don't spend a lot of time outdoors, so my body has, I guess my body's trying to figure out what time is sun time. You know, we have these kind of inner thoughts. Anyway, I'm glad that still able to bring benefit. Our tradition is, words. You can categorize things any which way you want. Someone asked me this today. A guy came, knocked on the door and said he wanted to learn about meditation. So I gave him a book, talked to him, and he asked kind of the same thing, and he started talking about Mahayana Buddhism. So we're Theravada Buddhism. What that means is we follow the teachings and the opinions of a group of elders, starting with the Buddha, but based on a specific set of texts, which we claim, as all traditions do, claim to be both the orthodox teachings of the Buddha and the orthodox explanations of the teachings of the Buddha. That's called the Theravada. Thera means elder. Thera means elder. Ovada or Vada, Vada I guess means the teaching or the view or the way of explaining. And within the Theravada, of course, there are still many different ways of understanding those explanations and those interpretations. And there are even people who come from a Theravada tradition but have discarded a lot of the traditional explanations of Buddhist teaching in favor of their own explanations. And our tradition is fairly traditional. We do follow the orthodox interpretations, mostly. But that's because we follow the Mahasi Sayadaw, who was very much steeped in the traditional culture of the Theravada and very knowledgeable about it as well. But even he argued sometimes with the commentaries and gave his own interpretation, or it was open to some giving some leeway in that sense. But still Theravada, most definitely Theravada, and gave a specific meditation technique that he sort of gleaned from his teacher, but also from the Visuddhimagga and texts like that. So we often call ourselves the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition, because that's our root teacher who sort of started, or popularized anyway, this meditation technique. It became very popular once he started, because at that time Burma was in its Buddhist heyday. It was really a stronghold of Buddhist practice and study. This was before the military coup and junta that followed, which is, it's interesting that all that came after such great Buddhist practice. It's like Mara coming in, you know? Mara can't take all that goodness. It comes in and destroys it. You're breaking up still, Robin. I'm assuming that's at your end, that your internet's got a problem.
Could be, sorry about that one thing.
Or maybe it's my audio, but I think my audio is fine this time. It doesn't sound like my audio problem. Let me see here.
Front, left.
No, my audio is fine. What would it be? Could be Google. Okay, in the beginning. No.
That's not
happening.
No.
No. doesn't even sound like it's an internet problem. Sounds more like it's a CPU problem, like your computer's stuttering, or my computer's stuttering. Oh yeah, that's
is
much
that
better.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay, I changed something in the settings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, how can one focus on studying the path, practicing, and teaching with no money? How can one survive without a job? My plan is to build a farm, to plant what I eat with one close friend, but we have to have money to do that. I see some people like you and don't know how they survive or if they work. I mean, working demands a lot of effort and time, basically most of your day. So how does one live without wasting your time in a company or without having to live in a monastery? I live with my family and don't work. I spend my time studying at home and practicing, and I suffer a lot from pressure from my family to move.
Move from your family, to leave your family?
Sounds like it, yes.
I mean, that's why, you know, it's funny that you say to not live in a monastery, because that's the whole purpose of monasteries. And that's the very purpose of them. So you want to go and build your own institution, where you build a farm and plant what you eat. Well, good luck. I mean, that's not the model that the Buddha chose. And you're right, it's not quite reasonable to think that you can do that. You'd need money. And even if you do that, you're still going to have to grow your own food, and you know, farming is not a joke. So if you want to know how can you focus on studying the path, practicing and teaching with no money, it's all in the robes. I mean, it's not just the robes, it's in the monastery, it's in the center. I mean, obviously, actually, I'm not a model because I'm sort of starting out on my own, so to speak. I don't have that kind of cushion. My cushion is all of you. I work, you can say, but I work teaching. So people think that worthy, and so they feed me. But in the monastery, you know, the people will feed the monks just because, as we saw with the quote, you know, these beings are great. It's great to have these beings around. Because they teach, but also because they provide an institution where we might come and do the same, or they provide, and just because they're praiseworthy. I mean, these are the kind of people you want to support. If all they do is help themselves, well, good for them. They're doing something that is a great help to themselves. That's worth appreciating and worth supporting. So monasteries are a great way for that kind of sort of thing to happen.
Yeah, the kind of homesteading movement that's so popular now. So many people talk about that and write about that on forums and things, but mm-hmm. That's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of work, especially people that live off grid and don't have electricity or anything. It's a lot of work. Also, it's common to cry and feel a great joy when being present and contemplating. Is it common to cry and feel a great joy when being present and contemplating things? I always cry and didn't feel nothing, just cry. Some people will call it experiencing God in all things.
We'd call it crying. But it's based on rapture, what we call piti, or rapture in the sense of this rapturous feeling. You cry out of joy. So those are feelings you have to say to yourself, crying or happy. It happened to me when I first did my first course in Thailand. It was also sadness and grief and just release of stress. Because crying is a great stress relief, but it felt great. I was crying for like an hour. green is if you're one of the meditators. Look at the logged in users, you'll see the same color scheme. Green means those people who have meditated recently, who are on the list basically. You see the list below? It gives the last 3 hours or so. If you're on that list, you're green. It's useful for us to sort of get a sense of who's meditating and who's not. That's the idea. I know that some people are obviously meditating at other times, but the idea here is for us to be in a meditative state when we come here. So we do wish for people to join here to have meditated with us in the past hour or so.
I think there was another question earlier up that I skipped that someone had asked why they were at zero when they had done some meditation before, and maybe it wasn't clear that it starts out at whatever number you enter and then it points down to zero. So that means that you are done.
Well, the list is, it's all about this list. You see this meditator list. Everyone on here should be in green. If you're not in green and you're on that list, then you're like, everyone's still clicking on the anamoda, and I kind of stopped clicking on everybody. It's a funny little game.
Let's say you're doing some type of breathing meditation. How would the technique be if you're trying to get vipassana or samatha?
I'm going to use that.
Same with walking, lying, standing.
Well, it's not so much the technique, it's the object. You know, when you talk about the breath is a concept. If you're going in, out, it's very easy to get to samatha because there's nothing going in, there's nothing going out, and in is just a concept, out is just a concept. But if you're focusing on the feelings, like the nose, or the stomach, or the chest, these feelings are real. So if you say to yourself, rising, the feeling of the rising, the tension, that's real, and so that's vipassana. But the breath going in and out is much more samatha. You could argue that there's vipassana in there, but it's not really, because in is not real. You're not experiencing it. And same with walking. But if you're walking, you're focusing. If you say to yourself, feet, maybe that's a bad one. When your foot moves, you say foot. Foot would probably be a bad, it will be a samatha meditation, because the foot is not changing. It's not real. It's not part of the experience.
Isn't the real conflict in a human mind the belief in truth or lies?
Belief in truth or lies. Well, belief is a huge part of the problem, but simple ignorance is really at the root. It's ignorance that leads us to believe lies. Ignorance is the real problem. And it doesn't take belief to give rise to conflict. Although maybe it does. Not necessarily, no, because a person can get angry without belief. I mean, it depends exactly what you mean by belief, but yeah, even with what we would traditionally call belief, without it, you can get angry, you can get greedy. But ignorance is necessary. If you don't have ignorance, if you're not ignorant, meaning in the sense if you know something to be harmful, you won't give rise to it. So once you understand that greed and anger are harmful, there won't even be the tendency to give rise to them. So ignorance is really at the root. That's why our practice is all about seeing clearly. When you see clearly, you give up ignorance and you give up wrong view. You give up belief in lies. But even still, you could believe a lie. An enlightened being could believe a lie. if it was clever enough, if someone came to an enlightened being and said, well, your house is on fire, well, it's possible that they might believe them if they thought they were trusting, even if it were a lie. I don't have many thoughts on that term. I guess it's a sense that, I mean, it's more a Mahayana concept, I think, although it may be mentioned in Theravada. There's a sphere of influence of a Buddha. Yeah, it is in the Theravada as well. That there's a sphere beyond which a Buddha doesn't exert influence. Although, we study this in the Visuddhimagga, that I think in the end, I don't know. Again, I don't have many thoughts on this sort of thing. It's beyond my comprehension of these sorts of things.
I don't remember the exact term of the Visuddhimagga.
No, but the sphere of influence. When we're looking at remembering past lives, I think it talks about, I think it was that one, it talks about this, the realm of influence of the Buddha. I'm mixing it with something else. I know Mahayana is big on that because they have Buddhas visiting other Buddhas and ridiculous stuff like that.
Buddha lands.
Yeah.
What is the significance of listening to the recitation of the Patimokkha each Upasana?
To remember the rules, you know, to keep the rules in mind. The idea is that as you're reciting them, the monks listening can recall whether they have broken any of those rules. And if when they're listening they recall, oh yes, I've broken it, they're supposed to sit up and say, excuse me, Venerable Sirs, I just remembered that I broke this rule. And then they're supposed to confess it and continue on with the recital. That's my understanding. It doesn't happen nowadays. Nowadays it's just recited and rather quickly in most cases. Nobody ever interrupts. Because what they do is they do a formal confession, blanket confession for anything they might have done wrong. Just kind of not really in the spirit of things, but it makes things a lot easier. Which may be a bad thing, I suppose.
Is it okay for me? As much as monks?
Sure. Or as little as monks. I don't do an awful lot of chanting.
How far should one go to help a family member?
No farther than is, you know, reasonable as a duty, as an obligation, as a meditation practice. If it goes beyond your own practice of mindfulness and practice of clarity and peace of mind, it's probably going too far. Because the idea is that helping others, especially family members, is a great practice. That makes you a better person. So if it does that, there you go. And if it makes you a foul, cranky, miserable person, you're probably going too far. On the other hand, it can be a good test, but you know, if it just makes you give rise to more and more defilements, then you're doing it wrong.
There's a question that I believe went with a question above. Does meditation help with this conflict, the conflict about the human mind believing in truth or lies?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've already touched on that. Meditation, of course, helps you see clearly, which gives up your wrong beliefs.
I don't understand why milk, soy milk, rice milk, etc. are considered solid food.
They're not considered solid food, they're considered liquid food. If you blend up a steak, it's still a steak. In fact, even meat broth is probably considered food. The point isn't what's considered food. The point is, what are the exceptions to the rule that the Buddha allowed? And he only allowed very few exceptions to the rule. The only exceptions he allowed are, in the evening you can have fruit juice. That's the only exception. Vegetable juice is also allowed. Or root juice. Fruit juice, flower juice, root juice, bark juice, I think. What did I miss? I don't know. Different kinds of juice. And then you've got, if you're sick, you're allowed to have oil or butter or sugar. And if you're and you're allowed to have keep those and have them for up to 7 days. And also, if you're sick, you're allowed to have any type of medicine. That's, you know, within reason. Of course, you couldn't claim that food was medicine. But things that cure diseases, and these are like salts and chemicals, you know, like pills, those kind of things. Those you can keep forever. But those are the only exceptions. So everything else is food. Everything else is considered not exactly, not just food, but it's considered yavakalika. There's different types of food. So yavakalika is most of stuff. Yamakalika is fruit juice. You're allowed to have it overnight. Sataha, I think the third one is called sataha kalika. You're able to keep for 7 days, and those are things like butter and oil and sugar. And then yavajivika, you're allowed to have for your whole life. Those are like medicines, like pills and stuff.
If someone's doing something that's not right, should you point that out with or without an expression of disapproval? Or should you keep it to yourself?
I mean, you can. As far as should, the only thing you should do is become free from suffering. If you keep that in mind, you're much less inclined to worry about the problems of others. Because in the long run, you have to ask yourself, is this helping me become free from suffering? That's your only responsibility. So, I mean, often that has to, that it's just natural to help people by letting them know what they're doing wrong. But quite often it's natural just to keep it to yourself. You just have to be wary that it's not laziness or indifference that's leading you to. Indifference can be actually useful, but this kind of stupid indifference that doesn't really see the difference between good and evil. If you see something is wrong and it's clear that this person can benefit from hearing that it's wrong, then it's probably a good idea to let them know that it's wrong. But only if you think they'd be able to receive it. Well, the worst thing is to be preachy. This is Buddhists can often be like this, Buddhist meditators anyway. It brings them great faith in what they do, and so they try to correct other people's behavior and fix other people's problems. So it's much more about when people come to you with their problems. Like if someone is clearly expecting you to react to their behavior, you should react appropriately and let them know, that sort of behavior is not cool in my books. I don't. Someone thanks me? This is getting weird. People are quoting me on the internet, and in our little internet anyway. And thanking me in books. I mean, it's great. It's great to be helpful. Someone's quoting you in their book, thanking you in their book. That's a great thing. I don't even know who that is, Thera Dhammo. Sounds a bit familiar, but not really.
Possible to put the name of the book.
Hmm.
What do you think of monks who laugh a lot and make a bunch of bad jokes?
Well spoken. Well, there's a difference between making jokes and laughing a lot. Laughing a lot's probably a sign of frivolity. Making jokes, I mean, I think to some extent a joke can be useful for disarming, you know, disarming a situation, breaking the ice. I think the problem is it has to be said, and I'm not actually thinking of the person mentioned here, but there is the case where a sermon is just full of jokes. A sermon or a preaching or teaching. But with jokes or without jokes, there's quite a difference between a teaching that in the end teaches you something and a teaching that doesn't. I'm in Thailand, I've listened to talks that were very entertaining. And I remember as a young monk kind of being like, wow, this guy's a great teacher. And then I looked over and the guy next to me was dour and frowning and scowling even. And he said to me afterwards, he said, that was the most useless Dhamma talk in the world. What is this guy even doing? And I thought about it and I felt really embarrassed because it's like, he's right. I really didn't learn anything from that. And not anything of any great value. So I think that's the worst, is when you give a talk that is devoid of any real value, but it was entertaining. I think there's also a lot of teachings that are superficial, so they're feel-good kind of teachings that, you know, give you some sort of common sense wisdom. So they tell a story of, you know, monks who tell stories, and these stories sort of ring true with you. So it makes you feel good, it makes you think, yeah, you know, that's really wise. And that I think is misleading as well. It's not wrong, but it's just not very profound. In the end, if it helps you live your life better, well, that's great, but it may not get you all that much closer to enlightenment. So there's these kind of teachings that aren't wrong, but are still inferior. You know, in the Buddha's time, they wouldn't give a talk without including the Four Noble Truths. This became a sort of a litmus test for a proper Dhamma teaching. Did it incorporate in some form or other? You don't have to mention them, but did it incorporate suffering and the cause of suffering? Did it connect these two and help people to see that they're causing themselves suffering, be free from suffering, to address the problem as well. It can be deceptive, you know, a really sort of informal teaching can actually include that. If it talks about letting go. Okay. So those are some thoughts. There's no such thing as a negative thought per se. The thought itself is neutral. But yes, how you react to it is negative or positive. So for example, you think about someone you hate. You think about them. The thinking about them at the very beginning is just a thought. It's actually neutral. Even if the thought is about, say, killing that person. When the thought arises about killing, it's a result of your perpetuating this narrative of wanting to harm the person. Because you want to harm the person, you give rise to this thought, hey, I should kill them. But it's just a thought. That thought, in the whole process of hatred, the thought itself is neutral. But when you say to yourself, yes, and when you grasp onto that as a good thing, that's the problem.
Even though the Buddha talked about it?
Well, we practice anapanasati, it's just we focus on the stomach. But yes, the Buddha practiced Anapanasati using Samatha first. He went through all the jhanas and gained all sorts of magical powers. That's called Jeto Vimutti. The path that we practice is Vipassana only. So it's not wrong, it's not, I don't discard it. But it's not Vipassana. For the most part, Anapanasati is Samatha. Anapanasati, for the most part, makes people feel calm and enter into great states of absorption. For the most part. Now, as I've said, it is possible to practice Vipassana, even Mahasi Sayadaw says so, in perfect agreement, even if I wasn't just going to believe what he said. It's clear that that's true, but my understanding and from what I've descriptions of other people, it's much more difficult to gain Vipassana watching the nose, say, because it's much more subtle. You watch the stomach, it's still Anapanasati, it's the mindfulness of breathing, if you must call it that, but it's much more coarse, much more obvious, much more unstable, much more challenging. In the sense of challenging your views and beliefs and opinions, forcing you to see impermanent suffering and non-self. Much harder to see that here. Not saying you can't, but it's much more subtle. I suppose that's just my opinion, but it comes from talking to meditators about it. Maybe he thanks me because I got him started or something, and now he's gone to the Ajahn Chah tradition. Not very flattering to think that he's changed traditions, but it could also be otherwise. Maybe he's in the Ajahn Chah tradition but has found my videos useful or something, which is nice.
What do you think of monks who smoke?
Oh, he's thanking me for the digital Pali reader, which is something else. It's nothing to do with this. Yeah, that was sort of a useful thing.
What do you think of monks who smoke but are saints enlightened?
I think it's easy to say that someone's enlightened. I think regardless of whether they smoke or not, a lot of those monks weren't what they were thought to be. And I'm only saying that not because I knew them or because I have any first-hand knowledge, but because 90% of people who have been thought to be arahants are certainly not arahants. And that's just simply because people are far too quick to call someone an arahant. And because monks are often give airs that they are enlightened and maybe exhibit magical powers that are interpreted as meaning they're enlightened. But all those arahants in that tradition, it's really funny that that group has so many arahants and they just sort of come from living in the forest for long enough. I don't know, that's cynical and it sounds like I'm just maybe don't understand that living in the forest is such a great thing, but if you read their teachings, often these teachings are not the teachings of an enlightened one. There's some weird stuff in that tradition, honestly. I mean, and I bet it depends on interpretation, but like, anyway, I don't want to really go into it, I suppose, but I honestly think smoking, not a good sign. But I think you have to understand that a lot of these monks were overestimated. And I've talked to these, I've lived in these monasteries with these people, and they'll pull out this guy pulled up his book and started talking about these monks. This one became an arahant in this place, this one became an arahant, and all these arahant, they're all arahants. Like, how would you even know? How would you even know whether someone was an arahant? And yet they just have this blind faith that all these monks are arahants. Because their tradition somehow has the monopoly on arahants. But I mean, of course, everyone thinks their teachers are enlightened. It's overestimation, there's no question in my mind. Some of them might be a sotapanna, some of them might even be arahant, but not most of them. It's not true. There's no question in my mind that that's an overestimation. Especially with those monks who smoke. Yeah, maybe they have magical powers, great. But smoking is a pretty clear sign that there's still something going on. The argument has been made that it was just a traditional thing, you know, that smoking was just what monks did back then in Thailand, which may surprise some of you, but it's actually true. I've in Thailand, in the villages, I've gotten cigarettes in my alms bowl, because that was a thing you gave to monks. So the monks just smoked, but you get to a certain point where you realize, you know, this isn't food, it isn't medicine. Why am I smoking again? You know? And you realize it's an addiction. I'm not convinced. I guess I could be convinced that it's possible for an arahant to smoke and to be a smoker, but not convinced that it's all that likely. Again, I think it's a big overestimation. It's much more likely that these are good monks, but still on the path themselves. Or often overestimating their practice through the practice of samatha. That's very common. For someone to practice so much samatha meditation that they become very pure in mind temporarily, not realizing that underneath it all they still have lots and lots of defilement. Or some defilement somewhere. Oh, and we're over an hour, so enough for tonight. And thanks for your help, Robin.
Thank you, Bhante.
Have a good night, everyone.